not starting as you keep talking.
Here is what I get. And
And so this is a loud sound, no sound, louder, softer, and again, zero. And this phenomenon is known as beats. And the number of bump, bump, bump that you get is called the beat frequency. However, what Young did was to overlap in space. And he did this starting in 1801 in the basement of his house on Welbeck Street, one of my favorite streets, of course. And here is a picture from his notebook. And what he has is light originating from this point and light originating from this point. And he has these circular waves coming out. And this is Young's own drawing. And I will show you a better picture of this, but I copied this out of Young's own notebook. However, here is a picture I like somewhat better, because this shows a light source which is equally spaced from two little slits. And here we have a series of circular waves that come out. And what I like about this is it shows waves originating, but here it shows a close-up of this point. And here you see the brown wave and the blue wave adding, as we would say in physics, in phase, so that there's peak to peak, trough to trough. And so you get this wave added to that wave, you get something twice as big, which in reality is four times as bright, so that's irrelevant for us. But this is so-called constructive interference. They add. Here, you see one peak and one trough, one positive and one negative and one positive, and they cancel, and that gives you a dark band or a bright band. And so I have, some videos which I can show you. First, this one. In which you can see ripples coming out from each of these places, and you can see how you get brights and darks in both those, in these places. You can see where they so-called constructively interfere and destructively interfere. And I have a second one, which I like. I'll show you that one as well. This is a so-called ripple tank in water, and they're just two little things are bouncing up and down together, and you can see the water waves coming out here. You can see this point. Notice it's in the middle between them, you get intense, and here you get cancellation. You can see these things are out of phase. Now, however, what I really want to show you is I can show you real honest to goodness physics demonstrations that work. Here is a laser spot on the wall over here, bright red, as this is a helium neon gas laser, not to be looked at. Please don't turn around and look in at that, it's not good for your eyes. But if we then put some slits a la Mr. Young, look what happens. You get an intense, dark, This is light that is bending around corners. Light is a wave phenomenon. Waves bend around corners, just like sound waves, just like water waves. However, the wavelength, the distance between peaks for light, as we will come later, is very, very, very small. And so the corner has to be very, very, very sharp. That's why I can hear around there, because the wavelength of sound is that big, the wavelength of light is that big, and so I can't see around corners. We can add more slits, I think. Now, I have one other thing to show you. I can do also a lot of slits. And if I do a lot of slits, and I put in a lot of slits in front of a white light, then you see over here, and over here, they're straight ahead. But there is white light, as Mr. Newton tells us, broken up into all the colors of the rainbow, red, the blue. And so, real honest to goodness physics demonstration. And that really worked. Okay, now, Newton himself did some demonstrations with this kind of, this effect is called interference, this overlap of waves. He did some things himself. I'll show you one of Newton's experiments. And he really didn't understand, but he sort of faked his way out of understanding. He did this experiment in which he took here, if you look at this, he took a lens. This is a lens which is round in the other direction. It's a plano convex lens. And he put it on a piece of flat glass. And then he shone light down on the top. And that's what he saw. Okay, that's the pattern he saw. These are called Newton's rings. Now, light comes in this way. Of course, this is glass, and so most light goes right through glass. It's quite transparent. But some light reflects from each of these glass surfaces. If you don't believe that light can reflect from plain glass, take your toothbrush this evening and hold it up in front of the mirror and then look at it at the side, and you will see two images of the toothbrush, a bright one that comes from the silver back of the mirror, but a fainter one that comes from reflection of the light from the front surface of the mirror. So light does reflect off of ordinary glass. And so what happens here at this point is some light reflects back up, some light reflects from this, goes through and reflects a little bit from this surface. The light from here and the light from here overlap when they reflect, and these overlap in a destructive way, making a dark ring. Over here, this slightly thinner, they overlap in a constructive way, etc. And so you get these rings. This technique is used today for testing the circular symmetry of lenses to see whether, and if you see a pattern like this, this lens is perfectly round. If it's not, what you see is either a bulge or a indentation in one of these rings, and you know you have to do some more polishing of the gloss. So that's a very common technique that is used by people. Now, there's a further problem, and this problem is going to lead to a much deeper understanding of the nature of light. There is a particular crystal that is called calcite crystal. It used to be called Iceland spar because it was first discovered on Iceland. If I take a piece of paper and I'm going to write on it the word calcite, and I put a piece of this crystal down on top of it, then what I see is two images of the word calcite. So that instead of just seeing, if I put a piece of glass there, I would see, of course, just one image. But if I put this particular crystal on top, I see two images. This is a very peculiar phenomenon. Moreover, if I take this crystal and I rotate it, just turn it, one of these images will turn with it and one will stay stationary. So one calcite will move as I rotate the crystal and one image of it will not. So very peculiar phenomenon. It was discovered by a Danish astronomer named Erasmus Bartholin in 1670. Iceland was a colony of Denmark, of course, at the time, which is why he had access to this kind of stuff. And Newton knew about this, and he didn't understand this either. And in his optics, he admitted that both this problem of the calcite crystal and the Newton's rings were difficult, but he manages to fudge his way out of it. Now, if I take a piece of calcite, and instead of putting it on a piece of paper, I take the calcite and I just shine a beam of light, like that beam of light, through the calcite, I get two beams coming out. Okay. And now if I take a second piece and I put these two beams through a second piece and I rotate the first one, what I find, and this is much harder to do, but if I do that experiment, is as I rotate it, one of these images will disappear, the other will be there, and as I rotate them through 90 degrees, the one that wasn't there comes back, the one that was there goes away. It's a very peculiar phenomenon, and one that nobody could understand in those days. Now, along came a very interesting young Frenchman, Etienne Malus, and he played around with this phenomenon, and he gave it a name. He called it polarization. And then he discovered in 1808 that he didn't need two calcite crystals, that he could replace the first calcite crystal by light that reflected off of the mirrors at some angle in the Palais de Luxembourg in Paris. What the heck he was doing, creating that light reflected from the windows of the Palais de Luxembourg in Paris when he should have been playing with his kids or something like that in the gardens. I have no idea that this is how physicists are sometimes. Unfortunately, what this Toltec is the phenomenon of polarization had nothing to do with the crystal. With this marvelous machine, I can go backwards. It has nothing to do with the crystal particularly, but it has to do with the light itself, because it can come either from the crystal or from glass at an angle. Unfortunately, poor Mathers died at the young age of 37 in 1812, just at the time when the argument between waves and particles was really getting hot. Then in 1818, the French Academy had a contest to write papers defending either the particle, they called it corpuscle, but the particle theory of light versus the wave theory of light. And a young man, 30-year-old man named Augustin Fresnel, submitted a paper. He too, unfortunately, died at a very young age of 39. But and what he did was he was defending the wave theory of light, and he said, light will bend around corners, right? Because that's what waves do. They bend around corners. Now, one of the judges was another very famous physicist named Simeon Poisson, and Monsieur Poisson ridiculed this paper. He was a big supporter of the particle theory of light. He ridiculed this, and he said, this is ridiculous, because he then made a mathematical demonstration. A very smart guy. Oh, Monsieur Poisson made lenses, and if you go over to the Mouilly Point in Cape Town and you look at the lighthouse, it will have Fresnel lenses. Fresnel lenses, not Poisson lenses. Sorry about that. Fresnel's lenses. Anyway, they're both smart guys. Monsieur Poisson said, look, this is ludicrous, and he showed that mathematically that if you take a circular black disk and you put it in front of a light beam, that the wave theory of light would say that there would be a bright spot right in the middle. And everybody knows that if you put an object in front of a light beam, it's dark. All of it makes a shadow. Except Dominique Arago, another judge, who went along and actually tried. He actually did this, and what he found was, there's the shadow, and lo and behold, right in the middle is a bright spot. And there were rings around it. And so this spot ought to be called the Agagov spot, but it is, of course, called the Poisson spot, so that we make fun of a man who was a very great mathematician and scientist. But it is still called the Poisson spot. And it's easy to understand if you use the wave theory of light, because if I have a circular disk, and there's the shadow of it, every single point on the surface acts just like one of Mr. Young's two slits. And the distance from every point on here to the center is exactly the same. And so every light beam that originates from every single one of this point, points on the circumference, will meet at the center and make a constructive bright interference. This is what Poisson said and what Arago demonstrated. And in fact, it is true. So this is, just like Young's experiment, a wonderful demonstration of the wave nature of light. Young and Arago became very good friends, and Arago served as an intermediary between Fresnel and Young. So they all wrote one another. But Young made a very grave error in his analysis of light, which was not uncommon in his day. Because Young was working in analogy with sound waves, after all, remember. He did all this stuff about the human voice. Now, sound waves are what are called longitudinal waves. A sound wave is carried by the vibration of, say, air molecules or molecules in whatever the material is. And it's just like a slinky wave, so that you get, these would be a band of air molecules and another band of air molecules, and they're bouncing back and forth in the direction of the motion of the wave, which is going along this way. Okay? And so sometimes they act very close together, and sometimes they're spread very far apart. And this is the wave moving along. And that's how we hear. It is this pressure that occurs on our ears that pushes the eardrum, the tympanic membrane, in, and then pulls it out, and then puts, and then in, and then out, and then in, and then out. And that's what causes the vibrations, which then cause these little hairs, most of which have disappeared in my ear, to wave back and forth, and that is connected to the auditory nerve and then to the brain, and that interpreted as sound. And it wasn't until actually James Clerk Maxwell in 1864 that we got a complete theory of the transverse nature of light waves. Now, a transverse wave looks like this. Here's the direction of travel, but the direction of vibration is up and down. This could be a water wave, for instance, or the wave on a string. And the distance between the peaks is called the wavelength. And so this is a different kind of wave. It's called transverse or perpendicular wave. There it is going along. Okay. And what Maxwell showed is that light is composed, actually, as we shall see, of two such oscillating waves. Here is a picture of a light wave as defined by Mr. Maxwell. Here we have the wave going along in this direction, but it has two waves, not just one, but such as a string wave or a water wave. It has a wave of electric effect, and it has a wave of magnetic effect. And notice that this is a transverse wave, that is, the effect is perpendicular to the direction of the wave. Moreover, the electric effect and the magnetic effect are also perpendicular one to the other. Now, this particular wave has the electric field or electric effect in the vertical direction, and this therefore would be called vertically polarized light, if this is a light wave, but it's any kind of electromagnetic wave. Okay? This would be called vertically polarized. Most light that we see is not polarized at all. When you see light from a light bulb or light from a candle, it has every possible direction. So these two pink and or red and blue things are rotated around. They occur in this direction, in that direction, in the intermediate direction. And so there's no polarization effect at all. But there are quite common polarization effects. For instance, skylight is rather strongly polarized. So not sunlight, and please, please, please don't look at the sun. Okay? Don't even look at the sun at sunset, although it's somewhat safer to sort of glance at it because the light has gone through a lot of air. But please don't look for long periods of time, even at the sunset. It's not good for your eyes. But if the sun is, say, up here, and you look over here at 90 degrees to the sun, that light is rather strongly polarized, and you can demonstrate it to yourself with a pair of Polaroid sunglasses. So you look over here at 90 degrees to the sun, which is up there, and then rotate your head to sideways, and the sky will suddenly get very much lighter blue. The molecules in the Polaroid sunglasses are asymmetric in the same way that the molecules in calcite crystals are asymmetric. This effect is even stronger for glare light, so that the light that reflects from the ocean or from snow, if you're ever on a ski slope or something, that light is very strongly polarized. Both of these lights are polarized in the horizontal direction. So this electric thing would be in this direction, the magnetic thing would be that way. And the Polaroid sunglasses only allow electric effects in this direction. And so glare light just doesn't get through because it's like a picket fence. And if you try to run a stick up and down a picket fence, that's great. If you try to run it back and forth, it doesn't go. And that's what Polaroid sunglasses do, and that's why they charge you more money for them. Now, there are very good reasons why Young and his compatriots didn't know this. And that has to do with the nature of wave transmission. Because every wave needs something to wave in. Maybe that's almost logical. Sound waves do not propagate through vacuum. They need air or water or a metal or something through which they can move. Waves need a medium. Light waves, therefore, also need a medium, everybody said. Well, it's a very interesting medium because let's think of a string wave sometime. Now I can take a string and I can stretch it between two points. And I can snap the string at one end and a wave will propagate down. If the string is very taut, the wave goes at high speed. And if I let it slack off a bit and I stop it, the wave leisurely goes down. And so, but light waves go at an incredible speed. Everybody knew that even then. And therefore, the medium that's transmitting light waves must be very stiff, very taut, otherwise it wouldn't go fast. Now's the problem, because light travels a huge distance. The sun, the closest object making light to us, is 150 million kilometers away. It takes 8 minutes for the light to get here. The sun could have exploded 4 minutes ago. We wouldn't know for another 4 minutes. So I can guarantee you that that hasn't happened. Well, almost guaranteed. I have about 4 billion years of experience. That's a lot. If you go out at night and you look at the stars, the brightest star in the sky, don't look to the west because that's Jupiter and it's not a star. But the brightest star, sort of overhead, is Sirius, the dog star. That's the brightest star in the sky. That is 10 light years away. Light started out from that star on the 27th of January, 2001. And it's just getting here. And that's close. It takes light to travel across our galaxy 100,000 years of where many people are out here. Probably. So, light has to travel through a very stiff medium, but that medium can't have any friction because the light can't get tired going through it. Moreover, the Earth is moving through this stuff all the time, and it's not slowing down. If it slowed down, we'd have fallen into the sun a long time ago. So, the characteristics of this medium are very strange. They have to be very stiff and friction-free. We don't know of any medium. any materials like that. Maxwell gave it this wonderful Victorian name. He called this medium the luminiferous ether. It's really a delightful statement. And it surely must exist. You can't have water waves without water. You can't have string waves without strings. You can't have light waves without the luminiferous ether. So everybody looked for it at the end of the 19th century. And by the end, by the 1890s, two Americans by the name of Albert Michelson and Edwin Morley did some very sophisticated experiments, and they couldn't find this ether. And then, of course, in 1905, along came this bright young guy in the Swiss patent office named Albert Einstein, and he said, well, it doesn't have to exist. And since you can't find it, it doesn't exist. Now, Maxwell actually provided the answer himself. He actually provided the answer himself, but he didn't appreciate the fact that he had the answer. Now, I want to show you the answer. I can't resist this, and I apologize in advance. But there's the answer. Now, this is, this is just so beautiful. This is it. You know, these are four equations, and everything we know about electricity, about magnetism, about optics, in four lines. What a genius thing this is. I mean, this is stunningly beautiful. But what this tells us, this is magnetism, and this is time. And it says if magnetism changes in time, it creates electricity. And this says if electricity changes in time, it creates magnetism. And so if we look back at this picture, we've got magnetism changing in time, creating electricity, and we have electricity in changing in time, creating magnetism, and they pull each other along. They don't need anything. These are the most unique, different kinds of ways of anything in the universe. They come all by themselves. They don't need any medium to come along. Now, this time for cycle in visible light, such as this light that you see or that red light that you saw, it's very short. The time for one cycle is 1.5 10 to the minus 15 seconds. That's 1.5 thousandth of a trillionth of a second. Or another way, there are 670 trillion vibrations every second. That's a lot. That's a very big number. This is visible light. This is blue-green light. We see this all. I mean, here it is. 670 trillion times every single second. Now, and this is what the electrons in our cone cells vibrate in sync with these. The distance in space between these two things is 4.5 10 to the minus 7 meters. What that means in reality is if I pluck a hair from my head and I look at it, not in length, but across the width of a hair, which I can barely see with my eye, that there'll be over about 220 of these blue-green wavelengths that can fit across one hair out of my head. So they're very, very small in wavelength. Remember, sound waves are this big. Light waves are that big, 220 across the hair. And so that means that whereas sound waves can bend around a big corner, light waves require a very sharp corner to bend around, and that's what we saw before. Okay. Now I want to talk a little bit more about Mr. Young. I want to go back to Mr. Young's time. If you read the scientific literature today, and you read somebody's paper, and you read comments and critiques about them, and you read the ones in print, they're all rather polite. Not polite in private, but in print, people write relatively polite. I sort of disagree with this result. And that's true in science, but it's not true in the humanities. When I read journals like the London Review of Books, and I read the letters page in there, if any of you have done that, people write the most scurrilous things about one another. You stupid person, how could you possibly defend such a position? I mean, people really have it out with one another, and it's, you know, everybody gets a big laugh. Now, science wasn't always so kind, and in 1803 and 1805, a man named Henry Brougham, later Lord Brougham and later Lord Chancellor, wrote an anonymous review in the Edinburgh Review of some of the work of Thomas Young. And I would have thought that Lord Brougham was a relatively intelligent guy, but then he became a politician, so I think he was a strong believer in particles. And this is what he wrote. And I quote, "We expose the absurdity of this writer's law of interference, as it pleases him to call, one of the most incomprehensible suppositions that we remember to have met in the history of human hypotheses. The paper contained more fancies, more blunders, more unfounded hypotheses, more gratuitous fictions, all upon the same field upon which Newton trod, all from the fertile yet fruitless brain of the same eternal Dr. Young." Young eventually replied in a similar manner, "Conscious of his inability to explain these experiments which I have advanced, too ungenerous to confess his inability, too idle to repeat the experiment, he is compelled to advance the supposition that it was incorrect and to insinuate that my hand may easily have erred. Let him repeat the experiment and then deny the result if he can." That's great fun. These guys are really having it out with one another tonight. And this, as I say, goes on among scientists all the time, in private, but not in public. We're much more polite than that. Now, Young wrote something, and I want to put that out for you because it is one of the most cogent arguments, and I will read this out for those in the back. In this manner of explaining a new theory, we necessarily begin by assuming principles which ought, in such a case, to bear the modest name of hypotheses. And when we've compared the consequences with all the phenomena, experimental work, and have shown that the agreement is perfect, we may justly change the temporary term hypothesis into theory. This mode of reasoning is sufficient to attach a value and importance to our theory, but not fully decisive with respect to its exclusive truth, since it has not been proved that no other hypothesis will agree with the facts. This is a remarkable statement. When I was in the United States, there are a lot of people who make the claim about Darwin's theory of evolution that it is only a theory. But it is not an hypothesis, it is a theory. It has been tested and tested and tested again. And so this inability to understand the difference between these two things is a rather serious one, I think. Young published all of his papers in 1807 in a volume called A Course in Lectures on Natural Philosophy and the Mechanical Arts. Two quarto volumes of 1,500 pages, and he includes all of the papers he ever wrote and some other papers all the way from Greek times with comments of his. And for whatever reason, whether it was the scurrilous attack of Lord Brougham, or which was anonymous, by the way, and of course this reminds me, I mean, anonymous reviews are really troublesome. Remember that perhaps some of you who were here last week remember that Leibniz published anonymous reviews of Newton's work, which made terrible trouble for both of them. And very recently, a very fine scholar of Russian history, Alejandro Figes, published numerous anonymous and very unpleasant reviews of a competitor in Russian history who had much less reputation than he did. And eventually he got caught to his intense shame. It's not a good thing to do. But for whatever reason, whether it was Brougham's attack or because actually he had to support his wife, he never had any children, Young stopped doing science in about 1807 and returned to doing medicine. But in that same work, lectures, etc., he described a quantity which is known as Young's modulus. Young's modulus is the ratio between stress and strain in a material. It's a measure, really, of the elasticity of solid objects, and it's essentially the ratio between the force that's trying to change the shape of an object and the deformation that that force causes. This is still of utmost importance in engineering today. And he also describes in that book, in those journals, phenomena that have come to be called capillary action. The word capillary comes from the Latin for hair, capillus, and in very narrow tubes, it is possible in very narrow tubes for liquids to flow uphill against gravity. This phenomenon, which Young described and measured and tried to explain, plays a major role in us, for example, and it is the reason why blood can flow uphill from here to here, whatever it does, which is all that. But how it can go uphill against gravity. And that's because of capillary action. So I have a picture here of two tubes. These are very narrow tubes. On the left is water, on the right is mercury. And this surface, which is concave in this sense and convex in this case, is called the meniscus. And the shape of the meniscus is due to electrical attraction. So if you look at a water molecule in here, its neighbor to the right and its neighbor to the left are both water molecules. And so it is pulled equally strongly to the right and to the left. But the water molecule right at the edge is pulled to the left by another water molecule, but to the right by a glass molecule, and that pull is stronger, and so it was pulled up. Here, at this edge, the pull of its neighboring mercury atom on this side is stronger than that of the glass, and so it's pulled in that direction rather than in this direction. Electrical forces are very strong. They are much stronger than gravitational forces. Not everybody believes that, but I can give you an easy example to show that, although you must not try this at all. If you were to jump out of a 100-story building and you fall, it's gravity that causes you to fall. And if there were no air resistance, it would take you somewhere between 8 and 9 seconds to hit the ground. How long does it take you to stop? Not 8.5 seconds, microseconds, milliseconds, nanoseconds, I don't know. Not very long. The force pulling you down 300 meters from the top of that building is called gravity. The force that stops you is called electricity. Much stronger. That's the best example I know of the relative strength. Now, capillary action is tremendously important because, as I said, it's what allows blood to flow uphill. It's what allows trees to get water and nutrients from the ground way up there to the top through these tiny little tubes. All of this was described by Thomas Young in 1807. He's a very remarkable man. And he was able to use his understanding of this problem to make an estimate of the size of a water molecule. Now, he got the answer wrong, because he had wrong data to put in, but he made a very clear and sensible analysis of the size of a water molecule. Now, this is the early 19th century. This is decades, even a century, before people were really sure that atoms and molecules even existed. So it was a remarkable thing on his part. Now he's doing medicine again. And the study, the status of medicine in the early part of the 19th century was, to be very blunt, abysmal. And it has been greatly elucidated by the historian of medicine I mentioned yesterday, Roy Porter, in some of his books. And here is one of them, called The Greatest Benefit to Mankind, Quack's Favors in Transplanted Medicine. And we'll talk about Quack's Favors in Transplanted, because there were lots of them in the early part of the 19th century. And as he puts it, Porter says, it is revealing that most of the anecdotes passed down to us about pre-modern practitioners center admiringly on their love of lucre and their success in getting it.
As the French would say, plus ça change.
Now, Young published two books, this one in 1813, this one in 1815. Nosology is the study of the classification of diseases. It comes from the Greek nosos, meaning disease, and ology, of course, meaning study of. But Young was considered by his contemporaries, to use a modern English expression, to be too clever by half. And so these books, even brilliant as they are, and full of information as they are, didn't gain him either fame or fortune. But the status of medicine at his time was, as I said, abysmal. And anyone who has seen the Alan Bennett play or movie on the madness of King George will have some idea of how bad it was. And so I have for you a little doggerel verse which was written about John Coakley Bletsam, a Quaker physician who died in 1815. And it expresses a lot of what people thought about medicine. And it goes, when any sick to me apply, I physics bleeds and sweats them. If after that they choose to die, why verily, I let them. I rather like that. Now, Young was asked to write articles for the Encyclopedia Britannica, and he wrote between 1816 and 25. He wrote 63 articles, of which 46 were biographies, and the other, of course, were about the following topics: alphabet, annuities, attraction, capillary action, cohesion, color, hue, Egypt. We will talk about Egypt. Languages, motion, resistance, ship, sounds, man. I mean, that's a lot of stuff. This guy, I said he was a polymath, and indeed he was. He also served on several royal commissions, one for the Navy about how to build better wooden ships, and one on trying to make a decimal system of coinage, weights, and measures. And his commission in 1816 did not recommend that such be adopted. A later commission in 1837 did, and it took the British, who are slow to move, until 1971, or 134 years, to adopt the decimal system of the coinage. However, better late than never. Now, with his interest in languages, it's not surprising that Young became involved with hieroglyphics. One of the things, by the way, he did in this language article is he referred to work by one William Jones, who showed in 1786 that there was a connection between Sanskrit and Greek, which hadn't been realized before that. Young wrote that up, and he invented a term for this group of languages, which is called Indo-European. And that term, obviously, which Mr. Young invented, has certainly hung around through time. But he was interested, as I say, in hieroglyphics. And in his, the Romans brought back numerous obelisks and things from Egypt, and there's always been a great fascination with things Egyptian. But the discovery of the Rosetta Stone, found by French soldiers in 1799, and now the most popular exhibit in the British Museum, made a big change. And here is a picture of the Rosetta Stone. In three sections, this broken part at the top is in hieroglyphics. This middle part is in Demotic, which is kind of a script version of hieroglyphics. And this bottom part is in Greek. And here's a picture of the bottom part. And people can read this. They couldn't read. There's the Demotic, which you can see. And I doubt that anybody can see much of that. But this is illegible. I mean, nobody knew what that was. Nobody knew what the hieroglyphics was. But they could read this stuff. And this last sentence down here is the key to the understanding of hieroglyphics. Because the last sentence says that this is a legal agreement to recognize one of the dynasties of the Ptolemies as the official rulers of Egypt following the conquest of Egypt by Alexander the Great. So the stone dates from around 200 BC, and the Greek states that this legal agreement is to be inscribed in Greek, in the holy language, which is called hieroglyphic, and in the language of the people, which is this Demotic. So this stuff says the same thing. And that's the key, because I can read that, I can learn to read that. And so off they went in the early part of the 19th century. And so what people started to do was look for names such as Ptolemy, which is over here. And at this time, they made an assumption that this Demotic language was alphabetic, so the way Greek is, but that hieroglyphics, this stuff, that this was an ideogrammatic language, symbolic language, like Chinese, in which each symbol here represented a word by itself. And then in 1811, one French scholar made a brilliant deduction, because on the Rosetta Stone are, and on the hieroglyphics part, are a series of cartouches, which look like this. Cartouche means cartridge in French, and this round thing looked like the cartridges for the French rifles. And somebody said, well, look, in Chinese, when you want to write a foreign name, do you write special symbols to tell you that you're switching from ideogrammatic, from symbolic language, to a phoneme language, so that you can write out a foreign name in Chinese characters? And maybe what these cartouches were was an exactly the same thing, namely a symbol that all of a sudden I'm going to put in a foreign name. And so they looked for Ptolemy, and that's the key to understanding hieroglyphics. The stone was found in the town of Rosetta, of course, in the Nile Delta, and it was sent to Alexandria. There was a war, of course, going on. Nelson had beaten the French fleet in the Battle of the Nile in 1798, and then we're now in 1801 where this was found, and this was sent to Alexandria for safekeeping, but Alexandria was under siege by the combined British, Ottoman, and Turkish armies, because the French had occupied since 1798. The French, actually, in order to stave off both starvation and scurvy, the French soldiers ate their horses. And a lot of people say that this was the start of the consumption of horse meat in France, some tradition which still exists to this day, as anybody who has been to France will know. But the British won, of course, in 1801, and the French were completely defeated and really shamed. because they were sent back to France in British ships, and they had to give up everything they had, including the Rosetta Stone, which, as I said, is now in the British Museum. Young was the first person to notice that certain a similarity between certain demotic signs and certain hieroglyphics. But he missed a brilliant idea that hieroglyphs were also a combination of symbols and letters. And that incredible discovery was made by the Frenchman Jean-François Champollion in a series of papers that he published in 1823 and 24. So hieroglyphs can represent a whole word, they can represent a sound of a word, or they can represent a name. Or a picture of the object itself. So there's lots of meanings. And then there was a bit of a struggle between Young and Champollion for recognition. Champollion gave Young no recognition whatsoever, and it is true that he was by far the greater scholar of this time. Young, being a polymath, spread his talents all over the place. Champollion was dedicated to the study of Egyptian things from the age of 11 years old. He taught himself Arabic, he traveled all over Egypt, he visited temples, he looked at stuff. He was really dedicated his entire life to doing this. Well, Young gave up his interest in hieroglyphs in 1827, but he continued his work in demotics, and he became the acknowledged master of the demotic language. Finally, this poor man, after struggling most of his life, died on the 19th of May in 1829, of severe atherosclerosis, just short of the age of 56, not old enough. He is remembered by a memorial in Westminster Abbey with containing this picture of him, this engraving of him, and the following large series of words. Sacred to the memory of Thomas Young, M.D., Fellow and Foreign Secretary of the Royal Society, member of the National Institute of France, a man alike eminent in almost every department of human learning, patient of unremitting labor, endowed with the faculty of intuitive perception, who, bringing an equal mastery to the most abstruse investigations of letters and of science, first established the undulatory theory of light waves, and first penetrated the obscurity which had veiled for the hieroglyphics of Egypt. Well, that's not entirely true, it's part of it. And so that brings to an end Thomas Young, that brings to an end this evening, and I'm open for questions, obviously, but mostly I want to thank you for bringing the traffic to come out here, and just for being such a wonderful audience. I have never met such interesting, intelligent, and really nice people as I have.
I'm sorry, Steve.
I say this is not a very clever question because I'm not